Warning, this is not your father's history. This is not the history your coach taught you in high school. And you won't find it on the History Channel either. No, you see, this is the history your mother warned you about. This is History Against the Grain with your hosts, Chris Padgett and Josh Weiner.
Episode 65, Catastrophic Damage and Progressive Collapse. Welcome to the podcast where we, in the words of Walter Benjamin, regard it as our task to brush history against the grain. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Weiner, and with me as always, Chris Padgett.
Hi, Josh. What do you got?
Dear colleagues, we have been informed by the Division of State Architects that in the case of a seismic event, Davies Hall may be vulnerable to catastrophic damage and become a safety risk. You heard those words before, Chris?
Geez, that sounds a little ominous. I'm sorry to say that I have heard those words, but not until you reminded me just now. I think I had already sublimated them somewhere in the dark underworld of my own psyche.
Yeah, so to give context for listeners, on the morning of September 7th, I arrived at my office in Davies Hall, ready to teach my class, also in Davies Hall on the American River College campus, and noticed I had an email waiting for me, and I opened the email, and those were the lines I read. I think I called you. Usually we text. This was a phone call worthy moment. So I think I called you right away. I think I was laughing. I think I was maybe in shock a little bit at that point. What do you remember about that moment, being told, by the way, I didn't read the last line, that we have made the difficult decision to close Davies Hall effective the morning of Friday, September 8th. So again, we get the email morning of September 7th, told that the building will be closed by the following day. What do you remember about that moment?
Well, I do remember getting your message, and you're right. You picked up the bat phone for that one.
Yep.
Went direct. And, you know, I have to tell you, I mean, let me be clear about this. This is a place that, you know, we have plied our trade semester in, semester out. You know, every class, essentially, I mean, with a few exceptions where if taught off campus or we've used another, classroom somewhere, but for all intents and purposes, this was our home, our professional home, the largest classroom building with the most professional offices on our college campus. And as you say, in one unanticipated, taken entirely by surprise email that morning, we were told in so many words that building would be closed forever. Essentially, for all intents and purposes, that building was now to be shuttered. And so, what's strange, because a lot of the sort of psychic trauma that I've experienced since then, I didn't feel initially, Josh, because, you know, you got to recall, right, what we've been through the last few years. And I think I would say it started with the fires, in Northern California. We don't call them wildfires anymore because they're entirely, the product of man-made global warming and climate change conditions. These are sort of engineered catastrophic fires, and they've had enormous destructive consequences, and including, somewhere in there where we had days of school canceled because of the smoke.
Yeah.
And the unhealthy air in the Sacramento region. There have been times, living in Northern California when the skies have glowed orange, in broad day. So we had that. And then, of course, COVID, where the college campus was shut down, the entirety of it, at least for a couple of semesters, and then only small parts of the college campus were reopened over time. And still to this day, it's really a kind of shadow of what it was in terms of, you know, the number of people, the number of students on campus every day. Even our building before it was closed, you know, Davies Hall, was only just beginning, you know, to get back to that kind of kinetic energy, you know, that you feel when you go, you know, in prime time, right, you know, to a college campus, that great energy that you feel. So all of that by way of saying that when you sent me that bullet, you know, my thought was, oh, this is another in a series of entirely unforeseen, somewhat catastrophic, you know, shutdowns. But really, I couldn't get my mind around it, to be honest with you, at first.
Yeah, I like I said, I was definitely not gleeful. Let me be clear about that. I had no idea how to react. I was making jokes. I just could not process the fact that, as we found out, that this was not a sudden decision made, that this was the product of about a year and a half of negligence and seemingly concerted decisions to ignore what was in front of them by administration that allowed this to happen and ultimately led it to be a sudden moment of closure as opposed to a slow, steady process or a process that was based on contingency plans. None of that happened. Instead, we were just informed one day, and the next day we were out after having, as best we could, removed stuff from our offices, whatever we could, which was for many of our colleagues, a very traumatic process for various reasons, but just a stunning failure on the part of administration, which is why the title for this episode both comes from communications we received in this process. The initial email talks about catastrophic damage, emails that we've later been able to read from the Department of State Architects, which was part of this decision making and part of the kind of study that ultimately determined that Davies Hall was not safe. Mm-hmm. Use that term progressive collapse. And so those are specific terms used in this event, but I think we're also seeing them as just a way of describing this broader crisis in higher education, that this is just, you know, one little localized example of.
Yeah, no, and we're going to draw that out here in a bit. Look, I mean, just to be clear for our audience, when you live in California, something like a seismic risk is sort of part of the landscape, wouldn't you say? You know, the ongoing project of retrofittings, you know, whether it be bridges or buildings or, you know, what have you, is just, you know, part and parcel of life along, you know, a fault line, you know, several fault lines.
True. Although, as we were informed by one of our geology professors, Sacramento is possibly the most stable area in the entire state, seismically. There's no major faults near. The best, you know, the worst we get is aftershocks from other quakes. But yeah, nevertheless, yeah, absolutely. Growing up in California, it's a reality.
Well, yeah, all by way of, again, explaining why I think my initial reaction, you know, why I was slow to appreciate what was actually happening.
Yes.
You know, because you go, I mean, immediately you start going, okay, well, you know, how are we going to fix this? And, you know, what's the short run? And, you know, but then it became clear, as you say, that what was actually happening, you know, was that there would be no short run fix for this immediate issue of where are our classrooms? Where are our offices? Where is our division office? And as we've come to appreciate, you know, all the various, you know, webs of community that those spaces, those dedicated physical spaces for us had created, you know, whether it be in our offices, where for me, you know, I had to peel 25 years of educational investment off in about an hour initially that day, and haul what I could. You know, I actually brought my little my little wagon, you know, my moving, I take the, you know, music festivals or, you know, carry the groceries up from downstairs, you know, is that I had to take it to the office that day and just basically, you know, as you described it, I mean, you know, what we could in a very short amount of time, you know, literally take off the walls, you know, pull the pins, the tacks, I have three bookcases full of, of history books. Grab a few. I wasn't gonna, wasn't gonna be able to take them. A few things out of files, and a lot of personal effects. So it's the kind of unraveling of your professional identity, your professional community in real time, quick time, double quick time, before you can actually kind of comprehend what was going on. But what we've learned is that the Department of State Architects had notified in June of 2022 our chancellor, our district, that that building, due to its construction in 1967, was now considered to be, along with other such buildings in the state, seismically unfit. And so there would be a process of investigating this and determining, by engineering standards, whether that ultimately, was the case. But the warning, as it were, the warning shot went out in June of 2022, and for reasons we have not been able to really ascertain from our district administrative leaders, but what increasingly seems like, kind of garden variety mismanagement, if not malfeasance, is that that word was never shared with the larger community until that morning, that Thursday morning, right? When we got that email and were told that we had to be out. I mean, our sort of running gag has been we were more like evicted tenants at that point, and have been treated more or less like evicted tenants by this sort of shamefaced administration that, through its own mismanagement and incompetence, has tried now to, in effect, cover its tracks and to frame this entire thing as in the best interests of our safety and, not surprisingly, student safety. What's best for students or something? Yeah, so there are a lot of layers to this for sure, but as you suggest, it is also emblematic of, of the sad disintegration or erosion, I think, of standards in higher education across the country. And the various battles we've talked about on this show, whether it be curriculum battles in Florida or funding battles like we see in places like University of West Virginia, where whole programs are being cut. You have these sort of corporate headhunter types that get brought in to start slashing departments. We'd experienced a little bit of that ourselves prior to Davies Hall being closed, in terms of the way our division was reorganized and renamed without any of our own, input or shared governance or anything. So, yeah, there are a lot of layers to this. And I realize it's for our listeners, it's probably all tumbling out at once, but it's been a profoundly unsettling couple of months, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we used that the term kind of skeleton, the term skeleton key. I think it was that last episode or two. I think it was two episodes ago now. And this is, if not a skeleton key event, like, one that opens up all this, it definitely is this kind of dropping of the veil. Where if you had any illusions about what this college was, how higher education worked, the nature of academic administration, the mission of higher education, if you had any illusions that those things were, if there was any, we'll say, agreement between what we think the mission of higher education should be and what administration thinks the mission of higher education should be. Those illusions have been firmly shattered if they were not gone already. We've talked about the bewilderers in the past, this kind of layer of society that kind of throws up the kind of magic tricks that keep you from seeing what's really happening. The bewilderers are no longer there because we're just seeing very, very clearly that those in charge of our school, and I think this is a broader, sick culture of administrative culture across the country, and I think that's in education, but just more generally corporate as well, which increasingly there's not much distinction between those two things. That this is just the outcome of the failure of this leadership as a broad category or class of people across every institution in this country, and certainly within higher administration as well. It's just hard to read emails from these people and think of them as having any of the same goals, any of the same values, any of the same visions of what our role should be in society that we do.
Yeah, it's so disappointing and even despairing at times, you know. I mean, I guess we're fortunate in one sense because, look, I mean, they've tried to put us into alternate spaces on the campus, right? Because we had classes already undergoing. The semester had begun. Yeah.
3 weeks in the semester. I should have noted this was
three weeks in the semester. Yeah, at first there was this idea that we were all going to revert to online for 2 weeks. But then the very next day, they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to find spaces for you. And as we know now, those alternate spaces, the reason they were available is because they were substandard. Mm-hmm. You know, the classes weren't already being taught in them, particularly, you know, in some of the, the portable, what they call the portable village, where you and I are both now teaching. Was never really set up as, I mean, it seems like campuses accrue these sort of spaces, you know, as stop gaps, and then they end up just sort of hanging around forever, but they're kind of dilapidated and cattywampus. I always feel like if I put a marble on the floor of my classroom, it would suddenly roll to one side, you know?
When students walk into my classroom, I can feel the floor rumbling.
Yeah, my classroom right now is 11 rows wide. I mean, we have 25 students in the class. So you could put like two students in each row across from one side to the other. It's about half the length of a football field is what it feels like in there. But anyway, that these alternate spaces were substandard. They put us in a classroom in a theater arts building that had no working climate control. And so here we are in really the hottest part of the Sacramento season, you know, which is the late summer, early autumn. September tends to be one of the most egregious heat months in Sacramento. And there we are, you know, in a classroom that had no working climate control, you know? And so they brought in this sort of old floor fan, old school floor fan, you know? And meanwhile, crowing is the administration about how thankful they are for the staff who has fixed everything and got it all working. And so when you say, you know, we read these emails, the gaslighting.
Yeah.
Has just been so egregious, you know, that being told that everything's great and fine and that, you know, crisis has passed and thanks to the staff and, you know, all these things. And we know, you know, whenever we get together with our colleagues or talk to each other, you know, in our Senate or what have you, or in one memorable occasion, you know, in a town hall with the chancellor himself, is that the actual cost of this thing, you know, in human terms, especially for the professionals, you know, who are, you know, charged with teaching these courses, that the real human cost of it, the psychic damage, you know, the utter despair, you know, that comes from this mismanagement and this cynical, you know, sort of use of administrative authority, you know, just comes flooding out. And so the title, you know, the title, I love the title of our episode today because that sense of collapse and, you know, we're going to talk about it on different scales. I mean, it's not like we've lost our perspective. We understand things are happening in the world right now, you know, on a sheer humanitarian scale that are, you know, unconscionable. We've been living with the thing in Ukraine for over a year now, you know, and the reports are just, you know, talk about despair. So yeah, we understand whether it's, you know, Israel, Palestine or Ukraine or any number, you know, of places where people, you know, have suffered from this kind of collapse of systems, you know, or of violence or whatever you want to call it. We understand that our little shady, you know, leafy campus in Carmichael, California, you know, that what's happened with Davies Hall doesn't compare to those sorts of things. In fact, our own president, college president, brand new, tried to shame us at one point, didn't she? By saying that she had been recently to a, you know, an unhoused women's shelter and she saw what real problems looked like, you know, so that we needed to, you know, we needed to I don't know what to do, to buck up and get back to work or something. And so
her message was really, we actually have it pretty good. So No use complaining, which...
Yeah, no use complaining. And yeah, what we see, I think, or what we've come to understand is that one way or another, you know, on a different scale, with different intensity and different human costs, That in some ways, this all reflects that kind of breakdown of systems that we've been talking about over now 65 episodes of History Against the Grain. That is, whether it's the underfunding and mismanagement of education, or whether it's some sort of, cynical, distortion of a democratic process like, January 6th or even the current, House of Representatives, speaker malaise. That these systems, which are created, beginning in the early modern era, to serve a particular material interest, of these imperial states, that they've reached a kind of a kind of stasis point, a kind of entropy or something point where they don't work, and the refusal to realign, or the the willingness to abandon, certain fundamental precepts in the case of higher education, a commitment to teaching, a commitment to the classroom, a commitment to shared governance with faculty and tapping the expertise of faculty, where you think you can just substitute glib corporate phrases and marketing, and that somehow you're going to restore what, 300 years of achievement gap or something, overcome the racial and class animus created by these systems by a lot of snappy slogans. When we know those of us who are on the front lines teaching in the classrooms every day that you can't cheat that you have to invest at that point of instruction. So yeah, do I see a connection in these systems? You bet I do.
No, I think your point about the crisis in higher education can't be solved by corporate slogans and this sort of thing. We had a funny moment where I looked up our past president. Our past president had been served for a year, and then she suddenly just ghosted. She was just gone. And then I heard that she had moved away. That was the initial message we got, to Seattle or something like that. And then I heard that she had moved back to the area, so I
Her
looked her up.
family, yeah.
I
More
looked her
time
up,
with
and
her family.
she's now the executive director of some, I don't know, some foundation or something like that. But the funniest thing was reading the letter that introduced her, and it was just so indicative of, again, that kind of sick administrative culture where she was touted as having spearheaded efforts, right? What that was the language, spearheaded efforts at equity, and it's like, yeah, well, anybody can spearhead an effort, but isn't the whole point to actually achieve an effort? And it speaks so much to the way that these things are run, is that the efforts themselves are that become the point, right? That the job of an administrator is to make efforts. Those efforts never actually achieve anything. And you've pointed this out, that every year we meet at the beginning of the semester, or twice a year, I guess, at the beginning of the semester for what they call convocation. And every year some administrator gets up there and says, our efforts at, closing the achievement gap have not succeeded so far. And there's been no, and I think they're using that as, well, you guys need to do better. That seems to be always the implicit message. And it's never directed back at themselves, who are constantly spearheading efforts that continually show no actual effect. And so that's where we are. We're being led by people who love to spearhead, who never achieve. And then, regardless of what happens, they fall upward to the next position to continue spearheading at the next level. And it really doesn't matter at this point whether it's in education or, corporate leadership or anything like that. There's no boundary between those two things at this point. They're part of this exact same structures of these systems.
Well, and you've been really great throughout these episodes, Josh, because of your training and your interest, for example, in histories far afield from the US, Indian history, Chinese history, et cetera, of bringing voices from what I call the colonized world, especially India, and the old British Empire. Because if we want to understand what's happening to us here and what we like to sometimes call the first world, all we really have to do is revisit those voices, because they're basically creating the script for what we're experiencing right now. It's just that it's all turned inward in a way, that these systems that have always projected these sort of soulless, bureaucratic, kind of top-down corporate style managing, onto other parts of the world for, reasons of material gain or empire building, what have you, have sort of turned inward. It's like, it's just starting to feed on itself or something. And so I'm reminded of what some of those writers have been saying for a long time now, or even more, somewhat more recently in the Cold War, like some of the writers behind the Iron Curtain.
Right.
I always think of someone like Václav Havel, the great Czech playwright, who would write these, searing, plays based on the utter insanity of the kind of apparatchik, bureaucracy of the Czech Communist Party, and always recognizing the real damage that they could do. And so, yeah, I mean, the things that we describe, I mean, so one of the things we come to terms with then is, so how do we fight back? What is the reparative course here? How do we rededicate? And as much as I'd like to say, in kind of like, 80s drama, Norma Rae, leading the workers out of the factory or something. We've seen strikes, recently. The auto workers are on strike as we speak. The actors are on strike as we speak. There's an enormous cost, and I have so much respect and so much, empathy for what those folks are doing. I don't know, and I don't think we've quite figured out yet how we save our system, our part of the system, which we've always seen as dedicated, to doing the actual work in the classroom of education, the thing that inspired us in the first place. And I don't know if we have the answer. So I don't know, what are we doing? We're doing the best we can, I guess, right?
We're doing the best. I mean, I've joked the other day that I've kind of become a nihilist about this. Like I'm just, I've ceased to care about a lot of stuff I used to care about in some ways. I can still, get up passionate in the classroom and that sort of thing. You've become kind of an animist, I joked, because we had just gotten in our class and we had a shared classroom in the former Davies Hall, the condemned Davies Hall. We had just gotten this beautiful new world map, free of political boundaries or anything like that. And you were sure you made a guerrilla effort to get into our classroom after the building had closed to seize back our map. But the problem is we have nowhere to hang it because we have no classrooms. So we teach on opposite schedules right now. Basically, I'm on while you're off, and you're on while I'm off. So we don't actually see each other on campus very often. But the other day, I spotted you across the parking lot as I was leaving class and you were going to class, and in your hands, this was this rolled up massive world map, which you carry with you as your totem, right? Of
Yes.
a world that has lo that was lost, and hopefully we can recover.
Yeah. What used to be my soul as a professor is now in the map. It has become, transposed or something to the map. So it is a totem. It contains my former soul, my former spirit. And I feel like as long as I can carry it around, that it proves my existence, because I wouldn't know otherwise, because we've been stripped, we've been shorn, of all the other, touchstones of our professional existence. And so, yeah, I carry it around. But let me tell a tale about you, because you have your own sort of errand in the wilderness here, because once we lost our offices, of course, the way your schedule lines out is you teach at 10:30 and then again at what, 1:30, and so you're in between. It was kind of your office hour time. Well, what are you doing? You don't have an office. Where do you have office hour? And you found a spot. I call it a park bench. I guess it's more like a kind of a picnic table, maybe you can
Yeah,
describe it.
metal table, yeah.
Metal table, but it's outside. Ironically, I think it's outside what's now called the wellness
Something like that.
building or the wellness center. And so you're out under the oak trees, adjacent to one of the main sidewalk thoroughfares that sort of heads over to the administration. And there you set up, your office. It's a kind of bucolic, the campus used to be a ranch, it's a kind of bucolic setting, in the shade. You're able to use the Wi-Fi, for your laptop, but otherwise there you are. And at one time or another, pretty much everyone walks by you, right?
Absolutely. They all laugh at me, but they walk by.
Including our our vice president of instruction and our college president, the very architects of this disaster, who now have to confront the visual totem of you, unhoused Professor Weiner, teaching from your park bench.
I basically decided I'm going to stay there now, specifically because I know the president walks by all the time. I know the vice president walks by all the time. And I just want them to have to, it's the pettiest thing, but I just want them to have to see me there.
Right.
There was a really funny thing. You had your students write like a little reflection on this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of your students wrote something like, "It's so sad. I saw a professor sitting at a table eating his lunch outside." I'm pretty sure they were talking about me.
Your little homemade sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. No, it's true. And how do we fight back? I mean, part of what the podcast has been that, you know, you've written letters. I have. We've attended meetings. You went to a board meeting. I took my class to a Senate meeting. I mean, you know, we're doing what we can, but I, like you, take a perverse pride in carrying that map around. And as you do, you know, seated there under the oak tree, you know, with your laptop and your sack lunch, you know.
Basically, we got to remain visible is like kind of the key thing that I'm getting from this, that we can't disappear, because once we disappear, then they get to ignore us even more than they already do. So,
yeah. So it's nice to have that little edge. You had us, you designed a t-shirt for us.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'll post it in the notes for the episode that comes from the sign that was posted. They put a cyclone fence around our building and little blue signs. It said Davies Hall is closed, and you were able to capture that and use it to emblazon a series of T-shirts that we now have in our merchandise, our merch store. But so we're still here. You know, we're still breathing, we're still podcasting, we're still teaching. And, you know, we're grateful for the things we have. We have enormous sympathy and empathy for folks in the world who are even, you know, struggling for house and home and shelter and that kind of stuff. You know, as I will look out the window here today, Josh, you know, in downtown San Jose, I can see folks who are unhoused, you know. I mean,
right. So. Yeah, look. And just to go back to that, I mean, as you said, we absolutely understand that the situation we're in, we're still very privileged in so many ways, you know, as opposed to what our president tried to suggest. There's no illusions about, you know, how bad we have it versus how bad other people have it. But the other thing that she didn't understand is that, you know, working in a community college, our students, you know, are the ones who struggle, right? That I have multiple Afghani refugees in my classes.
Yep.
Unhoused students who have suffered from abuse of various forms, mm-hmm. you know, any kind of, you know, human tragedy you can imagine our students have gone through. There's never any suggestion that therefore, because we lost our building, that we are in their situations. But we do want to suggest that there is this fundamental break that's happening in these systems that, you know, are responsible for large problems as well as these kind of smaller issues, but they're all part of the same continuum, we'll say, of incompetence, poor leadership, broken systems, and the like.
Yeah, exactly. Because ultimately, the thing that drew us into this line of work, and particularly in the community colleges of California, you know, was this sort of core conviction, right, that it mattered. You know, mm-hmm. that somehow the health of our world, whether it be, you know, in our teaching, in our system, or public education generally, or higher education globally, et cetera, that there was a value, you know, to somehow adding to the human capital, you know, of people's lives, right? You know, of bringing the stories of history, you know, of the liberal arts, of science and STEM, and a whole menu really of higher education. And unfortunately, we still believe that, you know, and so we're having to kind of adjust in real time on the fly to how we can continue to fight that that good war. But one of the things we're going to do in the episode today, now to transition back into our history without borders, you know, you had been working on a lecture just before all this went down. In fact, you had sent the lecture to me, and I was totally delighted to see the work you had done on it. Playing off some of the conversations we've had, we had with Graham Hull on the last episode about the centrality of the Haitian Revolution in the age of revolutions, and how that story of Haiti had been so long suppressed or silenced or admitted, you know, ignored, et cetera, in the major narratives of the West, the age of revolution. And so it's been, one of our early episodes on HAG was actually, you know, listen to Haiti, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we've been sort of, in a way late to the party. I'll speak for myself, you know, but sometimes when you get to a party late, there's some really good things going on already, you know? And so we've been able to take advantage of that sort of late party energy, you know, to develop our own perspectives on teaching and writing and infuse our courses even now with what we think is a really vital perspective. So I asked you to share some of that today on our episode, because in its own way, you know, the seismic danger that we're talking about, you know, which is both a reality in California for literal engineering, you know, concerns of building safety, et cetera, but also a kind of metaphor then for how systems can collapse and how even in revolutionary moments such as that is of Haiti, a Haitian revolution, the implications for seeing that collapse and to see how something might be reborn is fundamental to our perspective on the times that we live in. Am I saying that well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. And, you know, as you were talking, I'm just thinking of, you know, the warnings that came to our administration about the potential for the need to close our building. And, you know, somebody like Abbé Raynal in France, you know, writing about the Avengers of the New, or the, you know, kind of looking for portents of the arrival of a enslaved leader who could be the Avenger of the New World and being ignored. You know, so again, not to compare what happened to us to the Haitian Revolution, but when these systems break, it's usually not coming out of nowhere, right? There's usually some warnings happening. And certainly in the case of the Haitian Revolution, the warnings ignored prior to its happening. But yeah, I'd love to talk more about that. So let's go to segment two.
When you're in it, you can't see what's going on. Now I see that everything's wrong. People are toys to you. You'll play and play with one till you're bored and through. You may want it back when it's gone and flew, cause people are toys to you.
Yeah, one of the things we realized as we sort of explored the story of the Haitian Revolution in earlier episodes was the enormous potential that story had for changing the way we tell other stories and for even seeing those stories with a kind of new vision. We called it a skeleton key, you know, that kind of key that just starts opening up almost any door you need to open. And when I saw, because you told me what you were doing with your lecture, but, you know, when I saw how you were working that story in, you know, I thought it was a great example of how that skeleton key, you know, can work in real terms, you know, in terms of, not only just teaching, but also understanding something fundamental, I think, to, you know, to the tradition, the historical tradition that we all are, in effect, a part of, you know, that tradition of revolution and the understanding of, you know, racial justice and any number of related issues. And so not only the ongoing problems that Haiti as a nation, a kind of broken state, has today and how that goes all the way back to those, you know, those fundamental moments of breakdown and revolution and such, But also, you know, as the systems we live under, as we're suggesting in the episode today as well, systems that we could take for granted or assume are, you know, sort of impermeable or something, but which now show themselves to be all, you know, all too susceptible to breakdown as well. And what it then involves, as you're going to tell us, is a kind of fundamental rethinking of the, you know, many of the core concepts that we like to you know, to we like to invest in, you know, but which need a kind of maybe a kind of reinvesting, you know. So yeah, with that, tell us some more about Haiti.
Well, I mean, before even getting to that, I just this kind of came out of, you know, as I think a lot of our material does over the past few years, of just a dissatisfaction with the approach. I'll just say personalize it, the approach I've been taking to this concept of the Enlightenment and revolution. And, you know, I've been doing this for years, and I don't know if I've ever come out of that, you know, that week of the semester particularly satisfied with what I'd done. I, you know, you can talk about interesting stuff, you can have good conversations and discussions, but ultimately the question I was asking is what's the lesson the students are getting out of this? And I couldn't get past this idea. And this is, you know, really the inspiration is that we need to be able to understand this concept of freedom outside of a European context. And we need to understand that it wasn't only Europeans who discussed and who theorized notions of freedom. But that's often how it gets told in kind of the traditional Enlightenment version of the stories, that these are, you know, these scholars and philosophers, natural philosophers, whatever you want to call them, who become interested in these ideas of using, you know, rationality to design more perfect systems or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of issues with that. First of all, I just found myself talking a lot without inspiring, I think, good discussion out of it. I never actually ended up getting to talk about the French Revolution. I always ran out of time. So the French Revolution, which, you know, it ends up being kind of the central revolution in so many ways, ended up being just like something I rushed through at the end of the second class that week. And so what I kind of came to is, what if I totally recentered that unit, took out the French Revolution as, you know, the central story, which again, I barely even got to, talked about the Enlightenment, but talked about it in a kind of against the grain way, so that rather than talking about the invention of ideas of freedom and liberty, I focus instead on the limitations of their vision of freedom and liberty. And then lastly, what if I put the story of Haiti at the center of the story, as opposed to making the center, you know, the story of white Europeans revolting and creating these new systems in these very kind of limited ways. So that's
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not telling me you took out your lecture on Thomas Jefferson, where you recounted the life story of the sage.
It used to just be a full biography of Thomas Jefferson.
Freedom emanated from his pen. You got rid of that? Is that what you're saying?
I did. Wow, I cut it down. It's only 45 minutes of the class now. But
okay, right on. Okay.
No, but it is interesting because one of the things I included was, I hadn't seen this before. I think I shared this with you, but there's a letter from Dessalines, the first ruler of independent Haiti. He writes to Thomas Jefferson in June 1803, which I hadn't encountered before. But it's just a cool moment where, you know, these, you know, again, like when you stop honoring those borders that we're supposed to honor, right, you start seeing things that you didn't previously see. And, you know, the idea of the United States, that there could be correspondence between a Haitian leader and who was the person who at that time was president of the United States. You know, I don't think that usually gets talked about very much, possibly because Jefferson did not respond to Dessalines. But it's a good way of getting at, you know, Dessalines talking about an idea of freedom that fundamentally Thomas Jefferson didn't believe in. And so that, you know, kind of hammers home that point about what we actually mean when we talk about freedom. Whose freedom are we talking about? Who gets to articulate ideas of freedom? And then which of those articulations actually end up in our books, in our lectures, in our courses, in our general narratives of how these things work. And so that was kind of the idea, is what if we reframe this? What if we gave voice to different people sharing their visions of freedom? And then what does that help us understand about the world that gets created? Because if your idea is, you know, the French Revolution or the American Revolution creates liberty, creates freedom, then you're left in this problem of, well, but how does that make sense of a world in which slavery continues to grow in the United States, you know, post-Constitution, post-Declaration of Independence? How do you make sense of the fact that European imperialism explodes across the 19th century, you know, in a time in which we're supposed to be talking about the march of freedom and liberty? And so if we reframe it and focus on Haiti, I think you can do this probably with some of the Latin American revolutions as well. But Haiti is such a signal example because we're talking about the most basic of freedom, right? The freedom to not be enslaved, the freedom to have control of your own life, your own body, your own labor. And so to me, it's just the starkest example, or the starkest way of getting across that distinction between, you know, what are often kind of, you know, these airy expressions of abstract notions of freedom versus these extremely personal, extremely vital discussions of freedom by people who, more than anybody else in the world, lack even the basic freedoms that we associate with that concept. So that was kind of the idea.
I think you're right on, because, you know, traditionally the way it's taught is that the freedom story, as it were, like in U.S. history, the standard version history, you know, really did sort of emanate from the pens of great liberal thinkers like Jefferson, you know, like George Mason, John Adams. I mean, there's a kind of lineup of Enlightenment era intellects who fuel the, you know, the argument for American independence and liberty, right? You know, and that, and so in the sovereignty, what I call the sovereignty trap, you know, they are the movers and the shakers. They're the political elites, the formally educated, you know, sort of quasi philosopher statesman types, you know, for whom the Enlightenment sort of gets its, you know, its name. And that's how it was taught, that that's therefore the freedoms that we have inherited, you know, have come from those, what we sometimes call the magic seeds of liberty that those men planted, and that they've grown over time to encompass, you know, new claims of freedom, you know, Lincoln freeing the slaves, women getting the right to vote, you know, gay marriage. I mean, on down the line, they've become expansive and progressive, all from those germinal seeds that were planted by the founding fathers, as we call them in the U.S. So that's the enormity of what you're up against here, just in sort of narrative teaching terms, because that's what most of our students, probably most of us, that was the rubric under which we were educated, right? But, you know, what you're going to talk about here now with Haiti, you know, and your sort of exploration of this, you know, is how that is a very reductionist and rather misappropriated, I guess I would say, Josh, misappropriated idea for where the values that we would wish to embrace now, where they actually come from.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And this is, you know, this is an example. I truly believe this. I think I might have said this at some point about the 1619 Project as well, is that there are elements of the 1619 Project I like. There are things I didn't like so much, but I was basically okay with, you know, even amongst people who are critiquing it for whatever, that it's okay to kind of overcorrect sometimes. You know what I mean by that? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That even if this is not the perfect, you know, counter to the old narrative, even if it quote unquote goes too far, which I don't necessarily believe, I probably think it doesn't go far enough, but that it's okay sometimes when you have such a dominant narrative to just shift in the other direction as far as you can, right? Almost to kind of pull people just, you know, inches and inches closer to where you want them to be, even if they don't get all the way. And that's kind of how I feel about that. You know, about this unit is that I just wanted to cut out as much as I could of the old version of the story and then replace it with something new. And so where that began is I first wanted to get across something I've struggled with for a while, which is, you know, the Enlightenment itself. It is important to talk, but I do believe that because, you know, it is the foundation of so much of modern theories of freedom, liberty, and systems of government, all that kind of stuff. It very much is something that had this enormous influence across the world. for better and sometimes worse. But the first thing I wanted to do is try to globalize that movement so it doesn't just end up being a thing that happens in Europe amongst Europeans. And so that starts with two things I wanted to get across. First of all, that there is no enlightenment without a broader encounter with the world, right? That Europeans encountered the world partially as a result of those overseas empires they start building in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. And that encounter with the broader world meant that Europeans had access to a fairly wide range of information, more so than most people did, simply because Europeans were active in more places. That meant that European thinkers could read about societies that other people, a wider range of societies than other people could. That led to new questions amongst European scholars and philosophers and thinkers. It spurred doubts about prevailing traditions. And all that was very much inspired by interaction, right? By an encounter with a broader world. And so just as examples, Ottoman and kind of Chinese ideas of centralized meritocratic bureaucracy, that kind of stuff's not invented in Europe. Those come from encounters with Ottoman governance, Chinese governance, and then certainly the Chinese model of government run by scholars ends up being a huge influence on European thinkers as well. Because, ultimately, it's not a coincidence that by the time we get to the 19th century, state after state in Europe starts adopting this notion of a trained bureaucracy, right, who studies certain texts and learns certain information and competes with each other for positions. That's not a coincidence. That's a system that comes right out of that influence of China. And then the other thing I point to is there's kind of an indigenous influence as well. Graeber and David Wengrow write about the indigenous critique, and their idea is, and I've seen this, some people support this, some people push back against this, but their idea is that in encounters across particularly North America, French, English, Dutch travelers had to encounter indigenous people. And what they found in those encounters is that indigenous people had all kinds of critiques of their ways of life, of their systems, and that they're going to argue, and again, some people dispute this, some people are okay with this, what they're going to argue is that those indigenous critiques actually are hugely influential on a lot of the major Enlightenment thinkers in Europe. And so as an example, a French Jesuit named Biard said, or encountered with the Mi'kmaq people of of what's now Canada, says that while he didn't like the Mi'kmaq themselves, he reported that the feeling was mutual. This comes from Graeber and Wengrow's book. Biard says, they consider themselves better than the French. For, they say, you're always fighting and quarreling among yourselves. We live peaceably. You are envious and are all the time slandering each other. You are thieves and deceivers. You are covetous and are neither generous nor kind. As for us, if we have a morsel of bread, we share it with our neighbor. They are saying these and like things continually, said Biard. And then as Wengrow and Graeber continue, what seemed to irritate Biard the most was that the Mi'kmaq would constantly assert that they were as a result richer than the French. The French had more material possessions, the Mi'kmaq conceded, but they had other greater assets, ease, comfort, and time.
I like that a lot. I think what we're finding in the case of North America with a lot of the, we call the new native history, is just how deeply embedded these imperial systems were in the native ways of managing the tribal peoples, managing resources, mediating conflict, et cetera. Because, we're talking about a thickly populated area of North America, that Great Lakes region, which also then became sort of the imperial center for the British, the French, the Spanish at various times, the whole kind of St. Lawrence, Great Lakes, Mississippi Basin, and there were enormously sophisticated tribal confederations set up, right, through that whole region. And these are the brokers, for Europeans who are trying to establish connections and everything, from the fur trade to, any number, the trade in deer skins to, any number of imperial ventures. So to recognize then the kind of reciprocity, I think, of values, of ideas, of practices, only makes sense, right, Josh? I mean, the reason we haven't done this is because national histories tend to create those bumpers, those barriers, yeah. those blocks, so that these peoples get segregated or siloed, you know. And what you, as a world historian, you know, you're by training, you know, prepared to see kind of cross-cultural, you know, influences. So I see that very much at work here, and it's, you know, it's really exciting.
Yeah. And so, you know, what comes out of that is, you know, you start seeing all these European political philosophers, we can call them, talk about the state of nature in the 17th century. And it's, you know, the question is, well, was that just random? Is that just a random thing? They all start talking about this at that point, or is that specifically the result of this encounter with a type of people that they didn't previously think about? They didn't have a sense of, right? And so these, you know, and it's reductive, and it's can be patronizing to talk about that state of nature. They're essentially reducing these indigenous groups into, you know, almost animalistic in the sense, like they're not using reason and rationality like Europeans would. But what they also represent is something, depending on who you're asking, it's different. If, you know, Thomas Hobbes' view of the state of nature is different than John Locke, which is different than Rousseau. But the fact they're all having these conversations, you know, can very easily be understood as coming out of the fact of that broader connection with the world. And so we first of all have to understand the Enlightenment is not something created by Europeans, you know, kind of out of whole cloth, just of their own inherent genius, but it's the result of encounters with other people whose ideas are different, whose ideas are sometimes attractive, and who cause a number of scholars, number of thinkers to have to fundamentally rethink what they believe a society should be and how it should operate. And so that's really important. And the other thing I focus on is there's a very particular context in Europe that makes the Enlightenment make sense there in a way it wouldn't in other places. So that, you know, just as an example, the emergence of this competitive state system that privileged the war-making capabilities of the state that required the creation of large armies funded by higher taxes. Like, that's the reality of the 18th century, right? That's what all these states, if they want to be able to compete with others, have to do. And that means that for regular people, the experience of the 18th century is an experience with a state that's claiming greater authority over them, both in the sense that they can be, you know, placed into armies and forced to fight, but also just in the sense they have to pay taxes, which are now going to be, which are often now higher, and which are going to be claimed more efficiently by the state as well. So for Europeans in the 18th century, the broad experience is of a state that's getting more powerful. I've talked about this before, but that's a very different experience than, for instance, a Chinese subject of the Qing Empire would have in the 18th century, a place where the Qing dynasty's general view was that the best government does the least, basically. They were generally a pretty hands-off state, as much as Europeans like to complain about quote-unquote oriental despotism. The reality is that most Chinese experienced the power of the state probably less than a European, you know, than a French person, for instance, experienced the state, than a British subject experienced the state. And then something else like religious conflict, I've talked about this also before, but, you know, it's certainly my view at this point that religious conflict in Europe gets kind of universalized as just something that exists in societies. And then it gets superimposed upon places like India, for instance, to try to explain that history. When in reality, the particulars of religious conflict in Europe didn't really exist in other places to the same extent. And all this is a way of saying that, you know, when you think about European ideas of freedom and liberty that come out of these political philosophers, when you think about notions of tolerance that come out of the discussions and the debates and the writings of the 17th and 18th century, these are people writing about not universal values, not universal systems, but ways of altering their own society in specific ways. And so we want to understand that Enlightenment ideas, although they're expressed universally, are often actually very particular. They're very particular both in they're supposed to be solutions to problems that are particular to certain European states. And they're particular also in the idea, which is my next point, that they don't actually apply to everybody as much as they are using universal language. They don't apply to everybody, certainly not equally. And so the way I get into that then, right before I get to Haiti, is you can quote Article 1 of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, in which it is very clearly stated. I mean, think about this language here. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions may be founded only upon the general good. All right, that's a pretty stark statement, right? Is there, you know, any wiggle room within that statement as it reads in the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen?
Yeah, well, you wouldn't think so, you know, but as you're pointing out, you know, how these sort of maxims, you know, are meant to apply, you know, in the actual governing of people, there is all kind of, I found myself the other day, you know, writing about how when they say things like all men, you know, are created like Jefferson does, all men versus mankind, that the iota of difference there between men and mankind is that men can be a kind of racially limiting term, mankind generally, which I think is what they use, what the French use and the one you just read, maybe, you know, refers more universally, at least in philosophical terms, you know. So the more you read this stuff, I guess, Josh, the more you start to understand the kind of racially coded ways this language, you know, was used. And sometimes we're accused of that being our own biases, 21st century or something, but they were actually encoding those biases, you know, into the language. So, yeah, I mean, in answer to your question, no, it would seem to be absolutely universal, but as you're suggesting, that's not how it was necessarily intended.
Well, and so in preparation for this, you know, we've already watched in the class that, the animation in the slavevoyages.org website, which I would point people to because it's an amazing resource. And there's, you know, kind of a famous thing on there where you can watch the slave trade, right? And it's done through these dots that, you know, progress across the map from Africa to various parts of the West Africa to various parts of the Americas. And what you get from that is, you know, kind of a narrative of that trade. It's limited, as we talk about in class. There's a limitation to what you can learn from those dots across the map. But one thing they saw on that animated map is that at the same time the French Revolution was happening, at the same time Article 1 of the Declaration of Rights of Man and the Citizen expressed that men are born and remain free and equal in rights, the number of those ships arriving in Saint-Domingue, the future Haiti, was not shrinking by any means. It was getting bigger. I mean, the numbers were rising, in fact. And you can almost see the peak of that trade to Saint-Domingue is happening right in the years prior to the eventual abolition of slavery in the colony. So, you know, we have to understand that it's not just that these, you know, that they said these things, but they didn't totally mean it. It's that literally as they're saying this, more and more and more people than really ever before are literally being enslaved, being put into these conditions in which they are robbed of freedom and liberty and placed in these inhumane conditions on the plantations in the richest, as is often said, the richest colony in the entire world, Saint-Domingue, based on its production of coffee and sugar and indigo and other sorts of cash crops of that sort. So, you know, we get that direct comparison between the ideals expressed universally and then the reality that while that is being expressed, literally as it's being written, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of humans being transported and then placed in these conditions of enslavement, of torture, of early death, of all that. So
that, you know what? Let me throw in that's a really good point, because there's always this sort of undergrad, you know, mindset when you first encounter this sort of thing, like, oh, well, geez, they were just a bunch of hypocrites or something. But, you know, I think that's not what we're saying. I mean, look, there's duplicity, I guess, in all, you know, facets of political, you know, political behavior. But I think what we're saying, and someone like Tyler Stovall, the historian, you know, would say they understood what they meant. In other words, it's we who, through the crafting of national sort of uplifting, affirming patriotic national narratives, we who have been sort of misguided or beguiled or some bewildered, you know, into thinking it meant something else. They knew it. They were kind of hard-headed. They knew that their language was racially encoded. They never entertained the idea that somehow all men are created equal should literally mean some kind of radical commitment to, you know, what I call radical freedom, you know, colorblind, you know, racially inclusive freedom. It's just that I think we, partly because of an instance like Haiti being sublimated in the narrative or ignored or omitted, as you're going to show, I think we forgot just how pointed their own understanding could be. I mean, you know, a lot of these guys were invested in the slave trade that you're talking about, right?
Including, by the way, Thomas Jefferson and Marquis de Lafayette, who both helped pen the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen.
Right. I mean, Jefferson actually did his thing. It doesn't get in the Declaration of Independence, where he excoriates George III for fostering the slave trade, how it's his fault. But then turns around a few years later and sells like 31 of his enslaved servants. You know, so he's literally slave trading at that point. So it's our challenge to get back through those beguiling national narratives or Western narratives to understand on their own terms what they actually meant by this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and so the next thing I want to do, because I think, you know, there is a version of the story where you can credit the French revolutionaries for actually trying to express a radical notion of abolitionism, right? There is a real debate happening, you know, amongst the revolutionaries about the issue of slavery, which really does not happen to the same extent in the United States, for instance, right? So, you know, you really see there is a significant amount of radicalism in the French Revolution that doesn't really get as much in the conversation in the American story. So we can credit that. But I also, you know, again, in making,
you know what, I would only throw in there, my friend, is say that the most radical part comes in response to Haiti. You know, the French convention declares on February 4th, I know that day, it's my birthday, of 1794, the abolition of slavery entirely throughout all the colonies.
Right.
That was after, you know, the burning of Cap Français. That was after the initial declarations of abolition in Haiti.
Yeah.
You know, and so somebody like Danton, who's, you know, in the heat of the revolution in France at that point, is saying, yeah, we should have done this before, but we didn't. But now we're doing it. You know what I mean? And so even there, I want to say Haiti's the skeleton key.
Well, and that's what a point I was going to make is that the next decision, because, you know, as we've talked about, all historical stories are selected, right? They're chosen. The way we tell it is a choice. And so that next choice I made is I decided not to focus on what was happening and not to focus on those discussions in France, because it distracted from what was really happening in Saint-Domingue itself, where it was not a bunch of kind of abstract discussions of freedom and liberty versus enslavement. There were people increasingly across the plantations of Saint-Domingue who were conspiring, who were planning, who were plotting to take freedom for themselves. And so, abolitionism in Europe is worth considering. It's a useful discussion. There are interesting ideas you can get from that. But for this purpose, I really wanted to move away from that discussion and put the emphasis on enslaved people themselves, on free Blacks as well in Saint-Domingue, of that kind of gens de couleur, the mixed race people in Saint-Domingue, all of whom were making decisions for themselves, having conversations and discussions, figuring out the right way to approach things, but ultimately trying to reshape their world, right? Trying to, you know, reshape the social relations that existed in the context of this colony where slavery was the dominant system. So I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And I think, you know, recognizing that discussion was happening in France, I think in many ways that discussion distracts us from what's really important, as opposed to helps us make sense of what was happening. And so as we get into Haiti itself, you know, one thing I also like to stress is, and I should thank Bram Hubbell, because our past guest, I called upon a lot of the resources he had collected in his own Liberating Narrative site. And so you can certainly check out his writings on Haiti. But it was really a godsend as I was trying to put this together on a short time frame. But one of the things that you know, one idea that he pulls, and I borrowed from him, is a notion that you've focused on a lot, which is that, you know, enslaved people don't need to be liberated by, you know, by the state right? They seek out their own freedom in various ways. And one way to see that in Saint-Domingue is through people who simply ran away. As I titled the slide, even before revolution ended slavery, enslaved people liberated themselves. And so we have, just as we have in the United States, thousands and thousands of surviving newspapers which contain advertisements for escaped slaves. And each one of those advertisements suggest an individual who was taking incredible risk by simply deciding that they would no longer be part of the system. They would no longer subject themselves to the system. And so one example I use here from November 1790, from one of these escaped slave advertisements, and I'll let you respond to this after I read it, but Magdalene Creole, meaning she was born in Saint-Domingue, previously owned by Mr. Gurnemeau, about 29 years old, extremely black, skinny, tall, and pockmarked, has been missing about 3 months, presumed to have been lured away by the slave Hyacinthe of Mr. De Coudray, with whom she has relations. She has free relatives in Port-au-Prince and Petite Gouave, where she is from. She is in the habit of dressing up as a man and passing herself off as free.
Yeah, that's remarkable. You read those things against the grain, you know, because they were intended to reinforce slave owner authority and, recoup any lost investment and, you know, to punish and those kinds of things. But what they also do is they're a kind of tacit admission that the enslaver's authority is never as airtight as they pretend it is. Yes. And that these enslaved people are full of what we might want to call agency, or what I call self-sovereignty, you know, that even the description, you know, it's a kind of an unintentional witness description, isn't it, of this person's resilience, resourcefulness.
Absolutely.
You know, to evade, to disguise, to connect with the larger community of people, you know, who will provide safe harbor. So I really love that.
It's almost making a mockery of the system, right? It's almost it almost seems intended to make a mockery of the system, the way this woman is able to kind of flout her freedom against the system that wants nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, just a way of getting at the actors here, which don't have to be white Europeans having abstract philosophical conversations in the halls of power in Europe, that what we're seeing is on the ground level, individuals making these, again, very risky, very dangerous, but also very inspiring decisions to create freedom for themselves, even in within these conditions that are as horrific as you can imagine. You know, so I won't do the full narrative of the Haitian Revolution, but I think, you know, what I want to get across there, and I think if you try to, in class, narrate the entire 13-year story of the Haitian Revolution, you're going to get caught up in details. You're going to get caught up in trying to finish the story, quote unquote, to get to the end of the story, to tell a complete narrative. What I really wanted to stress, though, was simply that throughout this, right, there are inspiring moments, there are tragic moments, there are figures who you root for, there are figures that you may root against, all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, throughout, what we get is so many expressions of this desire for freedom and liberty. They're coming out of the mouths of people who, unlike the philosophers of you know, Paris and, you know, the National Convention and all that kind of thing, these are people who have known what it truly means to lack freedom, right? Not that, you know, somebody tried to tax them too much, not anything like that, but that they literally had no liberty over their own lives. And so what I try to stress there is, you know, the Enlightenment certainly is born out of Europe, but the most inspiring statements about freedom, about liberty, about the need to transform the world, are going to come out of the mouths of those who, you know, didn't get a formal education in many cases, who haven't read John Locke, right? Who haven't experienced, active involvement in political discussions, again, in the halls of power, but have this ability to express what it means to be free. And I would argue even more eloquent ways than out of these more famous philosophers in Paris, in London, in New York or Boston or Philadelphia. And so that's what I try to focus on. And I can just maybe end here, because I there's this famous moment. This is right before the Haitian Revolution breaks out and the plantations in the Northern Province erupt, where there's this famous meeting It's called, referred to as the ritual at Bwalk Kyaman. And at that meeting, there's this kind of ritual that happens. And so this is reported in various places. It's hard to know how literal this is, or how much this story was augmented over the years. But the story is that an enslaved man named Bukman Duddy, who was kind of an enslaved leader, who was had some kind of religious role within the larger society, in which a pig was sacrificed. There was drumming, dancing, and singing. And then Bukman Duddy was said to have given the following speech. You know the speech at the from the ritual at Bwalk Kyaman?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay. All right. It's so good. And again,
Yeah.
it gets at so much of what I'm talking about. The God who created the sun, which gives us light, who rouses the waves and rules the storm, though hidden in the clouds, he watches us. He sees all that the white man does. The God of the white man inspires him with crime, but our God calls upon us to do good works. Our God, who is good to us, orders us to revenge our wrongs. He will direct our arms and aid us. Throw away the symbol of the God of the whites, who has often caused us to weep, and listen to the voice of liberty, which speaks in the heart of us all. I mean, you can't find a better expression of that anywhere in a European text than what you're finding from Bukman Duddy in 1791, right?
Yeah, no, I love that. That's a primary source for
Yeah.
understanding this radical freedom. Yeah, absolutely.
And so I guess the last point I'll make is that so the Enlightenment is what it is. It these ideas emerge that certainly will have influence in later world history. But things like the Haitian Revolution, I think specifically the Haitian Revolution, will say, is an effort to push the Enlightenment further. In some ways, it's an effort to take those universal phrases, those universal ideas, which are so often very particularistic when you actually look at them, and push them to become what they claim to be. And so I'm going to read here from Julia Gaffield, who was a scholar of Haiti. She's the one who, as a graduate student, first discovered the Haitian Declaration of Independence, which had been lost and wasn't, nobody sure if it actually existed. She came across it in an archive. And she wrote a really nice piece about Dessalines, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who was the first leader of independent Haiti. And she says, quote, "The 1805 Constitution that followed the Declaration of Independence reaffirmed the abolition of slavery in Haiti, making it the first free black state in the Western Hemisphere. It also eliminated official racial distinctions. According to Haiti's constitution, all Haitians, regardless of skin color, would be considered black in the eyes of the law. In Dessalines' philosophy, race was an ideological concept. By securing Haitian citizenship, a person became black. Under Dessalines' rule, blackness was to be the source of freedom and equality, not bondage."
Yeah, it's such a great descriptor of that document, that 1805 Constitution. And honestly, when I first came across it myself, the actual document, I was a little bit at a loss because when you said there will only be black,
Yeah.
my was thinking in sort of binary terms, right? Of the way the Enlightenment sort of use of the concept was racially exclusive or something. I thought, well, okay, this is just, turning to, but as she points out, this was a way of universalizing what they meant. If everybody's black, if whites are black, if gens de couleur are black, if blacks are black, then there are no exclusive racial categories, right, to divide people into,
Right.
And so I thought, yeah, there's that's what everybody thought Jefferson was talking about,
Meaning, when you say everybody, you mean since that time, since that story got kind
Oh
of
yeah, no, I'm
canonized,
sorry.
right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
and those of us who were reared in this system, this
Yeah.
Western narrative system, that was supposed to be what he was talking about, But I thought it was a remarkable moment, for Dessalines, for the Haitian revolutionaries, and for historians of Haiti now to flesh that out. Because so much of the story was lost. I mean, it's not like, well, it was there all along, staring us in the face or something. But she had to, in effect, what would you call that, Josh? Being in an archive and coming across that Declaration of Independence document, of which there were literally no other extant copies, right?
Right.
I've heard to find that. What better sort of illustration, you know, of sort of excavating what was otherwise a lost history, you know, and bringing it back into narrative circulation? Just really
It's like
remarkable.
the historian's dream, right? Like that's the thing you'd always want, right? Is to be the to just find something that just reshapes your entire thinking about how the world functioned. You know, just discovery.
My gosh. And now it all makes sense, because now you see, like, the response where Thomas Jefferson, in that remarkable letter you mentioned at the beginning from Dessalines, you know, Jefferson doesn't respond, right? Or at least there's no record of his responding to it. We do have him talking about Haiti and his own anxieties about Haiti to some of his associate, you know, his sort of, you know, political comrades in the United States. And there's no question that now, as we look at the foreign policy, you know, the segregating, the quarantining rather, of Haiti by the United States diplomatically, you know, the onerous conditions placed by the French, you know, on the repayment, right? The reparations to slave owners from Haiti that crippled their economy, you know, and it's someone like Trouot, Michel Rouf Trouot, you know, who's really sort of the key figure in bringing about in recent times the silencing of Haiti. Now we can see why, right? You know, in other words, because these were profoundly unsettling narratives that were coming out of you know, of the Haitians' revolutionary commitment, you know, that would have undermined totally, for example, slavery in the United States, slave owning, you know, Jefferson on down, slave owning in the U.S. at a time when the United States will double down on slavery. You know, think of that, Josh. You know, what is always supposed to be the freedom narrative of the early national period of the United States, what kind of smoke and mirrors, what kind of sleight of hand is necessary? Because when you see the doubling down on slavery instead, and you see not only the exponential growth of slavery in the United States for the next 7 decades across what becomes the Cotton Kingdom, but you see also kind of doubling down on the concepts that justified it, you know, a kind of retreat from those revolutionary values that even on their face talked about equality. You don't hear that stuff anymore, right? Coming out of the political quarters of the United States. And we know why, because of Haiti, if not exclusive measure, in large measure.
No, and you've made this point in your writing that this is almost like a quarantine effect, that Haiti has to be quarantined because its lesson is just too dangerous to the prevailing system. And you know, I can read a little bit from that letter that Dessalines writes to Thomas Jefferson, but it's not a coincidence that this doesn't, I mean, it's not random this doesn't get responded to, because this is Jefferson's greatest fear in many ways. Dessalines writes, "The people of Saint-Domingue, tired of paying with our blood the price of our blind allegiance to a mother country that cuts her children's throats, and following the example of the wisest nations, have thrown off the yoke of tyranny and sworn to expel the torturers. Our countryside is already purged of their sight. A few cities are still under their domination, but have nothing further to offer to their avid rapacity." Can you imagine like a more terrifying letter for Thomas Jefferson to get than that? It's a nightmare, like come into reality, right? To receive that letter from a free black ruler of an independent nation of formerly enslaved people, who now serve as a model for what can be achieved. And you know, to use the title of the book by Laurent Dubois, these are the Avengers of the New World. And Jefferson, of course, want nothing to do with them, and their model to be excised certainly from the story.
Yeah, it's endlessly fascinating and you know, fruitful inquiry to understanding all these histories. What they called the contagion of what the whites called the contagion of liberty coming out of Haiti, you know, and the metaphor was really, you know, based on the smallpox metaphor, you know, of these viral contagions, and you had these vectors of, you know, epidemic spread, you know, disease carrying smallpox, which was ruinous in its effects, right? You know, but they saw that as the equivalent. In other words, the Haitian ideas about what they sometimes called French liberty, or was this dangerous thing. So it's quite a thing to see America's revolutionary leaders, men who proclaimed these universal, seemingly universal values that we celebrate to this day, you know, whether it be a 4th of July or what have you, an elementary school or K-12 textbook or something, seeing those very revolutionaries do this about face and now denigrate these things as terrible, as dangerous, as like a contagion, a viral contagion that is ruinous. Kind of almost hard to get your mind around at first.
Yeah. And it just as a reminder, as this Napoleon movie comes out in another month,
yes,
that even after having established, abolished slavery through their own efforts and meaning the enslaved people of Saint-Domingue, it was Napoleon, the hero of this movie. And I don't want to judge it before I see it. But I think when you make a movie like that, you can't help but glorify the subject to a certain extent. It's Napoleon who becomes convinced of the need to re-enslave the people of not just Saint-Domingue, but also Martinique and other French colonies that had where slavery had been abolished, that, you know, he expended the lives of tens of thousands of French and hundreds of thousands of people of Saint-Domingue to reinstitute slavery after about 1801, is that 1802?
Yes.
So remember that when you watch the future Napoleon film.
Right. And if we haven't already, overloaded you with ironies, keep in mind, it's his failure to accomplish that, right? That subjugation of Haiti, his failure to accomplish that only leads him to divest of his imperial properties in North America, what we call the Louisiana Purchase, and give Thomas Jefferson, of all people, you know, the bargain basement price for purchase of Louisiana, that then becomes essentially the great imperial extension of the fledgling U.S. nation across 800,000 square miles of Western continental territory. So what am I saying? In a way, it was the steadfast determination of Dessalines and those Haitian revolutionaries to ultimately stand fast and to defeat Napoleon's forces. I mean, this is Napoleon at his height, yeah. You know, to defeat Napoleon's forces in the field that ultimately makes possible that imperial brokerage of 800,000 square miles of North American territory called Louisiana Purchase, which then opens the door to the next chapter of U.S. imperialism across the West, right? So look, you'd accuse me of making that up if I just came to you as a movie script or something, right? Say, oh, that's absurd or something. But that's what happened.
Well, isn't there the further irony that a lot of that territory then becomes the new frontier of cotton production, which then expands enslavement and the system across
larger
portions? Yeah,
the subjugation of native peoples. Look, I mean, Dessalines and those guys came up with Haiti, you know, as the story goes, because it was the Taino, the native word for the island, right? Yeah. You know, and I mean, that's the best understanding of why they chose Haiti, because the avenging of the New World included then its native peoples as well as its enslaved peoples and that sort of thing from the, you know, the oppression of these imperial systems. And so, not only the Cotton Kingdom, but then, you know, the subjugation of native peoples in the Western territories as well. So, yeah, it's a tangled, what would we call it? A tangled web we've woven, you know, in that storytelling. But I think Haiti, again, offers us an opportunity to begin untangling, you know, those knots and understanding, I think, with greater clarity.
And to be clear, this is a work in progress. This is not a completed thing for me. I threw this together relatively quickly, in the context of the collapse of our college. But this is something that, you know, if you have interest in doing something like this in your class, it doesn't have to be finished, you know, right away. That this is something that can develop through conversation discussions with your students, through, you know, self-assessment of how well you were able to articulate the things you wanted to get across. And, you know, this is just one example, but it's the kind of thing that we should be doing particularly when we find ourselves just dissatisfied with the stories that we're telling. And I know you're like the avatar of being dissatisfied with the stories that you've told. But, you know, as much as world history has an advantage over national history, there's still a lot of bad stories we tell. There's still a lot of problematic stories we tell. And the more that we can just, you know, make these efforts to get rid of the things that make us uncomfortable. And I don't mean that like, you know, make us uncomfortable because it's, you know, controversial or something like that, but where we don't feel comfortable telling those stories any longer, the more we can rid ourselves of those stories and, you know, start telling different ones, that highlight different voices and get different versions of the narrative out there, I think the better we'll be for our own sanity, our own sense of pride in what we do. But also, I think it'll just expose our students to things that they often don't get access to.
Very well said, my friend. In fact, let's kick it to the last segment here and do a bit of a closing, shall we?
Let's do it. Hey, my game of fake member, call your back on it, Pafemu Malone, MC, you back for me, Lipacole, Lipocole, you get impassitated, so Mako Melady, Lipacome, you write something, Mako, Mako, makes me a vole, come back to your papi, papa, say your papi, receive a data, you get a pibaga, you be to Pacoe, you got me Pacole, you got me Pacole, you may be the church, you try, who pass me, but they don't be better, Mr. Jesus, Mr. Papa, Pata, this be super, 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 super,
I just want to sort of cap off what I think is so significant about what you were talking in the last segment about there, Josh, is that, you know, for those of our audience who teach, or if you just, you know, you're a person who enjoys understanding history, et cetera, is that the story you're talking about, the story of the Enlightenment, which has always ended in, particularly in U.S. national history terms, but, you know, I guess what we call Western Civ, and, you know, is that the story of freedom, which we like to, you know, we like to invest our own lives and governing systems with today, that it was really the result of this kind of gift that was provided by these Enlightenment thinkers, you know, French, and even Anglo and Anglo-American thinkers, as a kind of endowment for us today. And if you look at something like the U.S. Supreme Court, and there those, you know, the conservatives who hold this idea of original intent, the basic logic there is that you can go back to those documents, you know, be it the U.S. Declaration of Independence or Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen, et cetera, these kind of primary sources, you know, of the Enlightenment that have provided us everything we need to know over the last 200 plus years in resolving whatever disagreements we have about the meaning of things like freedom and liberty and et cetera, and rights, you know, natural rights and that sort of thing. And you know, one of the things that Haiti's done for both of us, and I think for a lot of scholars, is it's laid that bare, you know, that no, it wasn't the magic seeds of liberty planted by those Enlightenment figures, not to, again, as you pointed out, not to dismiss them as irrelevant or anything like that. But if we're really trying to understand the conflicts that govern our society today, we have to understand the very limitations of that story, that we're somehow supposed to believe that freedom was granted to us through this sort of semi, you know, mystical process of, you know, planting over time, flowering, sprouting, you know, a harvest somehow, you know, gained over time, and that therefore they are still entirely sufficient, you know, for whatever resolution of conflict we have today, when we know, in fact, that's not the case. We can't just go to the pen of Thomas Jefferson, you know, for example, or James Madison or somebody in U.S. history, you know, to somehow find the clarity, you know, of something like Black Lives Matter, because we understand those stories were never meant to advocate for Black Lives Matter, right? You know, in other words, they were never meant to be that kind of radical freedom, inclusive freedom that you were talking about in the case of, you know, of Dessalines and you know, Haiti and even the Bois de Camond, you know, the primal sort of expression of it early in the Haitian Revolution. So when we talk about changing the story, in effect, what we're saying here is changing the story so that the story not only makes sense to us and is grounded in, you know, our best research and that kind of thing, but that it actually offers us new possibilities for understanding, among other things, the conflicts we live with today. And you and I found a really cool kind of analog to that, didn't we? A couple of recent New York Times pieces that gave voice to what's happening in theoretical physics right now, particularly since the launching of the Webb Telescope, which has been a real game changer. You know, the problems in the story told by physicists, what they call cosmology, and that would be what the big story, right, of the past of our universe, you know, has had these sort of problems, not unlike the problems in the Western narratives we've sort of, you know, tried to examine, you know, the national history narratives and such, the Western civ narratives, where there had always been this sort of sinking feeling that, yeah, something doesn't quite fit, you know, I mean, slave owners proclaiming equality, wait a minute, you know, but we kind of sublimated those problems, didn't we? You know, in some sense, not so much world historians, you know, but I'm saying we in the collective kind of Western mode or something. Certainly Joe Biden, who could say this is, you know, this is who we are, you know, John Meacham, our friend. There's no shortage of people celebrating those narratives still today, but they always had a kind of disconnect. You know, and so when we looked at these, you know, very invested, very bright physicists who were trying to decide, so what do we do? You know, what do we do when the results of the Webb telescope tell us that traditional narrative, it wasn't just a few disconnects. It just seems to be wrong.
It doesn't work anymore. Yeah, it's really cool because we see this sometimes in history as well, where, and even outside national narratives, where there's like a story where that put together because it takes all these disparate elements and it kind of, and almost like scientists do actually, and we are social scientists after all, is that you can put these together and you come up with a compelling narrative that kind of makes sense of all this different data. An example I always go back to, and what we can talk about the cosmological example in a second, but I think it's just gets to the same kind of issue, is there used to be this idea of the people in the Americas based on an ice-free corridor, and kind of what it was based on is like, you know, the date in which this corridor opened up in the glaciers across North America was, you know, basically the same time that it seems like we start seeing evidence of the peopling of North America south of the glaciers. And therefore you can kind of come up with a story of, you know, peoples crossing the Bering land bridge, and then coming into, you know, what's now Alaska, and then the ice-free corridor opens up, and then they all kind of stream down into the Americas, and that's how the peopling happened. And just like that story dominated for like 40 years. And people are like, well, wait a second, what is an ice-free corridor and how do people move through it? What do we do with the fact that we have all this evidence of people showing up before the ice-free corridor would have opened? And at a certain point, the whole thing just collapsed, right? That whole story just collapsed. And now we have, you know, our story of the people in the Americas is far more complex. It's far more varied, right? There's multiple explanations. There's multiple migrations. There's multiple migratory routes. And it's just, you know, a great example of this attempt to hold on to a story that was so clean and neat and worked so well. At a certain point, though, you just can't hold on to those stories. So what happens when these physicists look through the Webb telescope? What do they find and what do they realize?
Yeah. By the way, I love that example because, you know, what it reminds us, it's not that, you know, shame on whoever came up with the ice-free corridor theory. You know, I mean, that's what we do, right? We venture forth, you know, these ideas, but the more, I think, to the point is that once the limitations of that interpretation became that it wasn't just more forthrightly maybe critiqued or set aside, but that had this kind of enduring life. We call it kind of a zombie afterlife, you know, ideas that won't die, right? Mm-hmm. You know? And that's what our physicist colleagues are dealing with now. One of the pieces in the Times this month was by an Italian physicist, Carlo Rovelli. And I want to read to just a statement of his, because I think it illustrates this so beautifully. Okay. And he's talking about cosmology. He's talking about the origins and sort of character of the universe. He says, this is what we do. The long study and a great love that is scientific inquiry. Inquiry, by the way, Josh, that's what the word history means, right? Coming from the Greek, to inquire. We combine and recombine in different ways what we know, looking for an arrangement that clarifies something. We leave out pieces that previously seemed essential if they get in the way. We take risks, albeit calculated ones. We linger at the border of our knowledge. I love that, by the way, linger at the border of our knowledge. We familiarize ourselves with it, and we spend a long time there, walking back and forth along its length, searching for the gap. We try out new combinations, new concepts. I think this is also how the best art works, says Rovelli. Science and art are both concerned with the continual reorganization of our conceptual space, of what we call meaning. What happens when we react to a work of art is not happening in the art object itself, of course, still less in some unphysical world of the spirit. It lies in the complexity of our brain, in the kaleidoscopic network of analogical relationships, which our neurons weave, what we call meaning. And so, yeah, I love that, because he's talking about meaning as a process of understanding a complexity, you know, of relationships. And we may stumble around, we may search high and low, we may get it right, we may get it partly right, may get it wrong. But what we do, you know, in that inquiry, in responses, is always looking for meaning. And I don't know why it is, Josh, but in national histories, oh, I do know why it is, actually.
Yeah.
Why the idea that somehow we all that work has been done for us, that it's no longer necessary for us to search for meaning, even when the ice corridor doesn't make sense,
yeah.
you know, anymore, that it becomes at that point, so what, some article of faith that we're not supposed to question or something?
It becomes a totem. You can carry around in your car and then take to your classes.
That's right. You know, it becomes a kind of relic, you know, of something that used to be, but which pretends to still have active meaning now. And I mean, I think that's often because how power prefers it, you know, yeah. As we've seen the narratives coming out of the Davies Hall closure, you know, is that we're supposed to accept explanations that really don't comport with the facts. They really don't line up. Because if we were to pursue that inquiry, somehow what it exposes, makes vulnerable or something, those who fancy themselves, you know, being in charge. Let me leave us here with one more quote. This is from an earlier piece in September in the Times, a headline, "The Story of Our Universe May Be Starting to Unravel." Boy, I couldn't resist that one, Josh.
That's good.
"The Story of Our Universe May Be Starting to Unravel." Adam Frank and Marcello Gleiser, the two physicists authoring this piece. Here's what they say. The philosopher Robert Crease has written that philosophy is what's required when doing more science may not answer a scientific question. It's not clear yet if that's what's needed to overcome the crisis in cosmology. That is the one, recently triggered by the Webb telescope. But if more tweaks and adjustments don't do the trick, we may need not just a new story of the universe, but also a new way to tell stories about it. Close quote.
Beautiful.
What do you think of that?
I mean, he's talking about physics, he's talking about cosmology, but it's the very same thing that we're trying to deal with. I mean, you talked about why, you know, well, I'll just say that, you know, Ron DeSantis is not trying to make it illegal to discuss these new cosmological stories in the schools in Florida. He is concerned about the stories we want to tell in our classes. And I think that kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, our narratives, the narratives that we're trying to unravel, don't exist just as, you know, scientific inquiries that come from looking through a telescope, that these are, for us, these are attempts to challenge the prevailing power structure, the prevailing systems, and to enlighten students, right, as to the nature of these systems. And so, you know, I guess, is it a badge of honor that the stuff we talk about is such a threat to people like Ron DeSantis? I think I'd like to think so. It doesn't make it less scary that this stuff is happening. But I think there's a lesson to be taken from those physicists. When the story's not working, just get rid of it, right?
Yeah, I think it takes a certain courage, you know, a certain willingness to suspend disbelief, even, you know, for a moment, you know,
yeah.
that there may be value in that kind of radical decision when so much is telling you, no, there isn't. You know, in our case, there's curriculum guidelines, there's transfer agreements. Mm-hmm. There's the whole episteme of how knowledge gets encoded and embedded and authorized and all that kind of stuff. And then when you're faced with having to go up against, you know, the literal threat of prosecution or something in Florida, you know, not just losing your job. I don't know. Is there a little jail for history teachers now? You're
history
in the
jail.
History jail wing of the penitentiary. But yeah, of course. I mean, whether it's, local professional crises and collapses like we're facing now on our own campus, or, you know, global humanitarian crises as we're seeing play out as well. I mean, that's what Haiti was. I mean, the Saint-Domingue, the revolution in Saint-Domingue, even though it subsequently was buried in the quarantining, of the country, at its moment was profoundly unsettling and profoundly influential, on just about everybody at the time, So how we choose to tell stories about it, say a lot about what it is ultimately I think we want those stories to do for us. Do we want them to encode and affirm the power that governs us? Or do we want them to liberate and begin to heal, the abuses of the of those systems? So I think by now it's pretty clear which side we're on, isn't it?
I hope so. But keep listening if you don't know yet, because we'll be back in the coming weeks and months to regale you with more History Against the Grain. This was fun. This was therapeutic. And we'll be doing it again soon enough. Talk to you later. Nobody is innocent. It's a sin when